Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves. Today is Mentor Monday, and we have one quick reminder from your Dog Show Superintendents Association. Get your entries in early. It's a win-win. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and today's guest is a very, very special individual within the American Kennel Club and the Canadian Kennel Club, Mr. James Reynolds. Jim has been judging dogs for 50 years, which I think is pretty amazing, and he's going to talk to us today about some of his experiences with 40,000 dogs. Is that right, Jim? Something like that?
It would have to be something like that, yes.
It's pretty amazing.
I certainly have covered a lot of dogs for a lot of years.
That is incredible. So give us, we call it the 411. What's your background? How did you get started in dogs?
Well, actually, dogs came along as a second career when I was perhaps 14 years old. It started off that my father bought a farm as a little investment, which my mother objected to strenuously. So my father decided that he would use me as the excuse. So I've shown cattle and horses and sheep and bantams and pigeons. And
awesome.
My mother always supported that, and my father actually, and the reason I stress my father in this is he also recognized, which I wish dog show people would, that if we could only enter two of any breed in a class, I was always given the best one. Not the herdsman, not my father, me as a 10-year-old kid.
Yes.
And so the impact of that was that I won. As a matter of fact, when I had a flock of sheep, very poor producing sheep, but they were good show sheep. And at 11 years old, I had the Grand Champion Ram. I got my picture on the front page of two magazines, national farm magazines across Canada, met the Prime Minister, and I was hooked. So that is what started, and with all these sheep. But my father also discovered that sheep need land. Like, I was using about 40 acres of land. And so when I was 14, he asked if I would be interested in getting a Boston Terrier, because that was a breed that interested him, and maybe showing it. And that was, anytime I'll take a dog over a sheep.
Who
and
wouldn't?
So we started off showing dogs. And that's how I got my first show dog, was a Boston Terrier, actually. And when I was able to pick my own breed, I was in university, first year university, and I took the Scottish Terrier, and that's how I got started in Scotties.
And that's amazing.
And it used to drive my parents crazy, because every time they would ask, what do you want for Christmas or birthday, I would say something alive. That was all I ever wanted. And so I stayed true to that over all these years, and then later after the Scotties, which we bred and showed, I fell in love with my Irish Wolfhound, so I always had an Irish Wolfhound as a house dog. We never raised them, we never showed them. They were just our special friends.
They are wonderful. I showed a lot of them over the years and always wished I had one just for my own. I love them.
And that's exactly the way I felt about it. And I was also fortunate in that I met some very important people and some very effective people in encouraging me in my career in dogs, not in judging. That wasn't their specialty, just in knowing about breeding dogs and loving dogs and respecting dogs.
Right. And so talk about that. Who were your mentors in dogs and in breeding and eventually?
What was very interesting is that I have to say, basically, I did not have anybody in Scotties. I literally had to read some magazines and find out some things about them and do some research. Taught myself to trim as much as I did, except for one man who one day, after he had a stroke, kept slapping my hand when I was doing something wrong. And so as far as the dog and breeding and showing Scotties, that really was a self-taught career, which is really rather interesting because I could present a Scottie reasonably well, but I'm not in the least artistic. I have no talent in this area. So why I could manage it with a Scottie and a Scottie coat, I don't understand.
And that's not an easy breed. I mean, there's a lot of finesse there.
And you look at some of these handlers like Eddie Boyce and Rick, who are artists.
Right.
And that wasn't me. So it really was just the love of the breed and the show ring that went from there. And then I met along the way, as I started showing Scotties, there was a lady in Canada, her name was Betty Hislop. And Betty's Karen Dania has dominated the ring and Karen for 40 years. She won 23 consecutive breeds at the Garden.
Wow.
And she needed somebody to drive her to the shows. And so the deal was I could bring my Scotty, go with her, and I got to show the Karen Terriers also that she needed because she always had four or five. And so that got me into the American show scene. It also got me into handling some of the best dogs because she brought all the top dogs from the UK. And that had an impact on the kind of Scotty I wanted to breed and I wanted to raise. And it was through Betty that I then met the people who were very influential in my judging career.
And who are some of those people?
Well, that is really easy, and it seems strange, I know, but one of the ladies I stewarded for at the Chicago International was a lady called Mrs. Augustus Riggs IV. Adelaide Riggs was an American all-rounder. She, in fact, had had Scotties at one time in her Hillwood kennels, and Adelaide liked me, and so she recommended me. One of the things, you may not recognize the name of Adelaide Riggs, as she was very famous, and you do recognize her daughter, Ellen Charles, who currently has our top winning dog in the United States for the last 2 years.
Right.
And one day I got a phone call from this man who said, I'm Chuck O'Neill, and that meant nothing to me. And he said, Mrs. Riggs can't cover her assignment at Bryn Mawr. We'd like you to come and do it.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I went to Bryn Mawr, was judging there, and another couple were sitting ringside watching me, Jack and Bea Marvin, who Terrier people will know, and they saw, and so the career started.
That is awesome.
It really was. I can still remember when they asked me to judge Best in Show the first time in Montgomery County, and I died and gone to heaven.
That would be heaven. That would definitely be heaven. I love it.
It was.
Okay, so we're out of order, but I got to know, which one was better, Best in Show at the Garden or Best in Show at Montgomery? Which one was more intense for you?
Well, Best in Show the first time at Montgomery County, because the sweeps judge had gone over, it was 6 o'clock at night, getting black diaper drain car lights up for me and saying, get it over quick, Jim. That was my first Best in Show, and it was intense. Westminster, strangely enough, was a great thrill. I was convinced they'd made a mistake. I've judged Westminster 14 times, but I was convinced they'd made a mistake when I got the letter to do Best in Show. And I was so happy, so excited, so everything. But out there in the center of Madison Square Garden with all my family and all of those people, with 19,000, it was just looking at those 7 dogs and deciding, okay, who belongs here? Who's the best? And I wasn't as nervous as you would think it was. I didn't find it nerve-wracking at all.
Wow. I think I would probably pass out.
And I must admit, the anticipation of it was such, I kept thinking, oh. And yet, once you're out there, if you're really focused on what you're doing, and I don't care whether it is Westminster or I've done one of the biggest shows in Australia, the biggest shows in England, the focus is on what's going on in the ring, and the rest of it just is gone. It really isn't there. Someone asked me if I heard the applause at the Garden when I was doing Best in Show there. And was I aware of applause? I certainly was aware of this noise background. But it doesn't impact if you're really focused on what you're doing.
Right.
Strangely enough.
Right. Okay, so 50 years of judging, some 40,000 dogs all over the globe. Talk to us, talk to our listeners. What makes a great one? We hear that all the time. It's a great one. What is it that differentiates between a great one and a good dog?
I think there is, they have a presence to them. It's a star quality. It's the same with an actor or an actress on stage, and some of them exude that star quality. They have the motion at the right time, the appearance. Westminster is a good example. Rufus was my Best in Show, the Colored Bull Terrier.
Yes.
And I judged Rufus on several occasions. And I must admit, when I went into that ring, I thought, well, it doesn't have to be a terrier, you know, terrier guy sort of thing. And that dog was so turned on that moment, that night. He said, you've got to do this. He really did. That was what was communicated to me. A couple of my other favorites didn't win because he had that moment. He'd taken that star turn, that moment when he was in the peak of condition, the peak of showing, and that's what makes it. And you find these great dogs that do this. Currently, we have several dogs in the United States that have that appeal to me. But it isn't. It's they have their type. They have a style to them.
Right.
And they have that desire to be there. They really do have a desire to be seen, to even if it's just to interact with me as the judge. And I must admit, I'm always a fool for a dog that will interact with me because for that 2.5 minutes that I'm judging, it's my dog. I love it. I love it when they become my dog.
Oh, that is so beautiful. Okay, so you mentioned type and style, and this is one that I really love. And I go back to Rick Beauchamp's book on this, and that there is a type, which is what that breed is. And then there are styles within the breed. And I'd like you to expand on that a little bit and give our listeners some ideas. I sent you the notes. We could use the two Scotties who've won 95 and 2010, two bitches, both exude breed type, very different styles. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'm happy to talk about it, but I'm going to go way back from year two.
Okay.
In the late 1930s and early 40s in England,
yes,
there were two Scotty dogs. One of them was called Heather Realization. One was called Auburn Barty. From those two dogs come, I would say, every Scottish Terrier that's in the United States today.
Wow.
They were the dominant factors. The Heather Realization dog was black. He was very short. He was lower to the ground with a little carrot tail. The Auburn Barty dog was a brindle dog, a little taller, a little bit his shoulder and rear, maybe a little long. Sometimes the back of his skull sloped a little more than it should be. He had a presence, a stallion quality to him. Now I'll take you ahead to the 60s, the two best in show Scottish Terriers at Westminster, Bardeen Bingo and Carmichael's Fanfare.
Mm-hmm.
Two very different dogs. One of them, the Fanfare Mamie, brindle bitch, little higher in leg, very sound, little shorter in head. The Bingo dog, lower to the ground, compact, absolutely fantastic length of head. They were both Scotties the minute you saw them, but they were very different Scotties, and they had that style that carried them all the way through. And then you carry on to the two bitches, which I find really interesting because, yes, they were very different bitches, but I'm willing to bet my bottom dollar that if you were to trace them back in history, they go back to Heather Realization.
Interesting.
I think one of the things I find very difficult is the fact that people really don't do their research. They don't study their breed when they come into it. So they don't understand some of the things that are happening. The bloodline carried, the phenotype is there, but there's a genotype, and that genotype is carrying a whole lot of things. I find that very frustrating. A few years ago, I don't usually go to judges' dinners. I went to one of a wolfhound club. And I started in, they asked me to speak, and I'm fine, Dandy was speaking. And I started in to talk for a moment about the three ladies who were so good to me, who really held this breed together in World War II and after World War II. And as you may or may not know, I used to be a teacher.
Right.
And I know when a class freezes over and eyes freeze and they're gone someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And I used those three names, and I could tell it meant nothing to almost anyone in that room.
Oh, dear.
And I couldn't believe that, how you could not know, not have done the research behind on a breed, especially one that they're all passionate about.
Right.
But they still hadn't paid attention to the past as they should have.
I feel your pain on that one. And I love that the knowledge that those two recent bitches, that you can see that so clearly in your breed, that they would go back to one of those original foundation dogs. I think that's fabulous.
One of the other interesting things is one of those original foundation dogs, the Barty dog, Mrs. Riggs had the opportunity to die and decided not to. And so no one knows what would have happened.
Right,
right. She'd come here instead of staying in England.
Oh my gosh, that is incredible. So terriers in general, and this is always interesting to me, those hard-coated, hand-stripped breeds, some of the greatest dog people in the world come from the terrier group. What's up with that?
Well, I think one of the things you have to take, if you actually look at all those terriers, it's a very diverse group.
Mm-hmm.
You get accustomed to top lines, coat differences, be it from a Dandy Dinmont to a Scottish Terrier to a Wire Fox Terrier to an Airedale. And so if you're a terrier person and not just focused on your own breed, and terrier people tend to pay more attention outside their own breed, then you're, I think, are given a wealth of information to work with. You see things that perhaps other people don't see or don't understand. And top lines are a great example. You take a Bedlington top line, a Dandy Dinmont top line, a Scotty top line, and an Airedale top line, put those four in your ring. Now what are you going to do?
You'd best know what you're doing.
You better. And that's exactly why I've always maintained that terrier people, among other traits, were marvelous, of course, among other traits, are very unforgiving.
Yes.
Terrier people expect people to know their terriers. I find some of the other groups' exhibitors are much more forgiving, much more generous in terms of what you do.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well.
But the terrier people, that you made an interesting point. If you're going to do a broken-coated terrier, then you don't have a day off.
No.
You can't have a day off. You can't overdo that hair that you pull or underdo it. And so you're always at it, but it becomes your work of art. As I say, I'm not an artistic person, but even I would feel that this hair had to be pulled, this had to be done to make the picture I wanted.
Right.
And I think that's one of the major differences. And we've had great ones, Rick, Peter, George. I mean, these are top terrier people, and they, for generations. Right today, and I know you know Roz Kramer.
Absolutely.
Nobody can put a Westie frame on the Roz can.
Wow.
The way a frame, you know, you look at these dogs, these West Hounds, like these great hairy mops all hairsprayed up. And then you see one that Roz has done, you understand what a frame is supposed to look like. And that's the talent there. Really talented people.
And I think terrier people, the myth is you look like your dog, you act like your dog, you choose dogs because they sort of reflect your personality, if you will. I've always found, with no disrespect, terrier people are like their dogs. You know, stand up, they're a little bit sharp, but they're very good people and very smart.
And we're not too forgiving yet.
No, not too forgiving.
No, but I'm not going to disagree with you. But we also can set a standard. I have a judge that I really set the standard for me as to what a judge should be. He's a terrier man.
Mm.
And interestingly enough, not one, probably anyone knows, his name was T.H. Crothers III. Mr. Crothers came from Cleveland, had a top kennel of wire fox terriers, actually won Best in Show at the Garden years ago.
Mm.
He came and judged a show, a terrier breeder show in Canada. And there is this smartly dressed man. He'd had throat cancer, so he had to speak using a tube and conducting himself as a gentleman all the way through. And you see your examples. You see the people you want to follow. And he was one of them. And I think that's important in dogdom, that you take a look and say, okay, I want all Annie's knowledge.
Yes.
I want to be able to be as knowledgeable as Annie is or was. This is sometimes gets lost in the gloss of it. The people kind of come in and take a quick look, do something. You really do need to observe over the years. And I think the terrier people have done that because they were a smaller group. Still they are today.
Mm-hmm.
The terrier group's a small group in most shows. They usually do very well at most shows, but they're a small group.
Right.
And so they get to observe one another, pay attention to one another, take a sideswipe at one another.
Never.
I used to, I told you, Betty Hislop dominated in Cairn Terriers, okay?
Uh-huh.
And I used to go, we'd have four or five dogs, and my greatest joy was beating her with one of her own dogs.
Right.
And one day I did this, her very favorite bitch I beat with a dog she wasn't fond of, called Errol Flynn. And as I walked by her to the best breed ring, she said, "You son of a..."
Oh my gosh.
Because it was a judge she really expected to win under.
Right.
So yes, we are competitive. We enjoy our competition.
Absolutely. And I think you made a point earlier talking about the artistry and all of the just hours and hours and hours and hours of really intense work that go into putting down a beautiful terrier, particularly a broken-gutted dog.
Exactly.
And
yes.
I don't know, I'm asking you, I don't know that I see, do you see a lot of new people coming into terriers and a lot of sort of rising stars coming up, young people coming up? I mean, we have some gifted handlers here and in Canada and around the world, but I'm thinking of young people in the U.S. particularly. I don't know. Do you see that?
Well, you have to forget, first of all, that many of the people I think you're talking about, you wouldn't see as young.
No, I see them as my elders, honey.
But my point in this, I think we do have some talented people there, and you can't start off at 20 years old with no background in terriers.
Right.
And be excellent, but you can learn quickly, and we do have some, and I do see them coming. I see them watching and observing.
Good.
There is a family of young men and a sister also, and I'm talking maybe from, I don't know how old they are, maybe 18 or 19 down to 12 or so. They come to the shows out around the Michigan area, and I've watched them watch and see, and their father's there doing videos of dogs, and they have learned tremendously. I watched one young man watch Leonardo with the wire.
Yes.
And the young man's trimming of that wire, of his own wire, improved tremendously. So yes, I do think that they are there, but it's hard work. So
yes,
you have to want to do the work. And that, I think, is more the problem than the lack of the talent, is that you want to or be willing to do the work.
Right. Absolutely. So switching gears just a little bit, as you're judging around the world, you're in all sorts of countries. I know I see you judging all kinds of places. Do you see, have you run into what three breeds, for example, would you think are in excellent shape sort of globally? And why do you think they are?
Interestingly enough, Siberian Huskies in Asia are very, very strong in most Asian countries. Mm. Part of that is due, I think, by the effect that some of the exports that Kathleen Kanzler made in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see these dogs, and there's a dog in the United States winning now that just came from China, a Siberian Husky. So that breed I find very, very strong, and in most of Europe, not the UK.
Okay.
But in the most of Europe. Flat coat retrievers. In Scandinavia, you would die to see the flat coat retrievers there.
Wow.
They are absolutely phenomenal. And again, I got to do some overload at one of the world shows, and I got the junior class of flat coats, and that was just so exciting. And I've done the American National 500 flat coats, so I've seen a few flat coats.
Mm-hmm.
The other breeds I do find rather diverse. I find some of South America, which I don't understand, in Mexico and South America, have really good bulldogs. I find that a very difficult breed, the atmosphere, et cetera, why that should be, but they do.
Huh.
And so when I go those places, the other thing that I must love are the sighthounds in Scandinavia, and especially the Salukis in Norway and in Sweden.
Wow.
They have just absolutely beautiful sighthounds. And, of course, we have a few other places, and such as the Lucy Saborza right now, who is our number one hound in the United States from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
She has American breeding behind her, but she is Asian, and they have in Japan, they have some lovely Borzois, basically through the Ozeki family.
Right. A number of our guests on the show have talked about this concept of the global breeding and seeing the results of that. And is that what I'm understanding you're saying, that you're seeing the results of taking and sharing this gene pool globally with a number of these breeds?
Oh, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I have not judged Scotties in Russia, but as you are well aware, the bitch that won Krups was bred in Russia, owned in the, and then more breeding in the United States, then went to England.
Right.
I mean, that's global.
Yep.
French bulldogs are supposed to be another breed. And you can see, and I've done well by Russian-bred French bulldogs.
Hmm.
Indeed, Russia seems to have become quite a hotbed in many breeds.
It's interesting. Desi Murphy, I was talking to him on an interview, and he said the same thing about Russia, and I think that's fabulous.
It is. The key is we don't get to see enough. You get to hear about them, or you get to see the odd one that comes in.
Right.
And you don't really get to get that overall picture because, of course, we rely so much on our publications and our online, but you don't see that much of the Russian kennels advertising, etc. And so it's hard to see the pictures that you know, is this just one or two dogs, or is it wider, until you hear a lot of people identifying the same
things.
Right,
that's
why I think... breeds, and then...
Yeah, I think hearing you guys both say the same thing to me is fascinating because, honestly, in my breed, we only see the occasional dog come from Russia and German Wirehair Pointer, so I don't think about Russia. So to hear from multiple people that they're seeing such quality coming from there, I think is wonderful for the future of the sport.
But you have to understand what we are saying also is that there's excellent quality according to our eye, and that gets us back to type and style.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, because there is, if you want, an American style in many, many breeds.
Yes.
Okay? And so some countries don't want that. I give you an example. Several years ago, I did Best in Show at the Ladies Kennel Association in England. It was their 75th anniversary show, and there were 14,000 dogs. Sometimes those breed entries are such that they have to have one dog judge and one bitch judge.
Right.
So the show superintendent comes and says, Mr. Reynolds, we are going to need you in the Golden Retriever ring. And I said, well, why? He said, well, you're, as the Best in Show judge, you're the referee when the two don't agree. And I said, they will agree. And he said, no, these two people will never agree. I said, they will agree. And they agreed. And he said, how did you know this? I said, they wouldn't let what they see as an American get his hands on their dogs. Different type, and they're not going to have an American type golden retriever person. And we can do this with Springers. We can do this.
Right.
So there is a difficulty in terms of sometimes that we're applauding because it's what we like and what we want.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the breeders in those countries sometimes have taken the standard and interpreted it very differently.
Yes.
English Springers are a good example.
A lot of sporting breeds. Wirehair Pointers are incredibly different
right.
in Europe.
Right. And usually we come back and say we prefer ours, which may be a little short-sighted on our part. Well, if we bring them in and get accustomed to them, you will see. We've had a tendency, and now we've got to be careful of what we're working on. For instance, England, many times, type will win over soundness.
Mm-hmm.
For me in North America, you can't have type without soundness.
Mm-hmm.
And so that leads to some very interesting paths of difference in what they're doing in their breeding programs. And now that we have such small kennels, in the old days of huge kennels, people could experiment.
Right.
And go and say, okay, I'm going to do that outcross. No, that didn't work. We have to do something else. Now our kennels are so small that they get into one thing and they really have to stay in it.
Right.
And that leads to some big problems.
It can, for sure. I don't disagree with that. And I guess speaking as a breeder, you were a breeder, you showed your own dogs, and the direction or sort of the current state of affairs, if you will, in North America and particularly in the U.S., there is a perception that as an owner-handler, people cannot be competitive and they can't beat the professional handler and that sort of a thing.
Well, and I understand, of course, that was part of the creation of this owner-handler class,
mm-hmm.
was to try and accomplish that. I'm not convinced it's necessarily true. I was always an owner-handler. The only time I used a handler was when I was working, and I had mm-hmm. to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd send a dog down and have it finished, usually in 2 weekends, and that was that.
Mm-hmm.
And no one knew who I was. But I think what we do have is a number of issues in judging of people lacking security. And so looking to what they would consider the more reliable choice as opposed to the person who's not handling the dog as well. Scotty people were really lucky because the Scottish Terrier Club of America in the early 80s sent breeders around the country. You could bring them into a seminar to your Scotty club,
mm-hmm.
and they taught people how to trim.
Nice.
And so the Scotty amateur owner handler was on a par all the time with the professional handler. And indeed, many of the professional handlers, they weren't all that keen to have a Scotty.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that they would meet that competition. But if you're going to go into a ring as an owner-handler and bring an ordinary dog and handle it in less than a way, then the handler's going to beat you. That's what they're paid to do. And I think people lose sight of that. It's easier to say, oh, well, you know, the professionals always win, rather than say, why do they win?
Right.
And, you know, it isn't the face of that. I mean, I get tired of that argument at all. I do think, though, that if they present the dog more effectively, if they make sure that there isn't a bad moment. Last weekend at the show we were at, I was telling someone, I said, you know, you were going select there. Except every time I look back, you're letting the dog stand there with his top line sagging to the ground instead of working on it.
Right.
And I think that is where the issue lies. I think an owner-handler, as a matter of fact, I think right now owner-handlers stand a really good chance if they just do the job and have the dog too. I think that's another thing that bothers me is all the money that is in our sport right now.
Mm.
Not all the money, but the money that if someone has a really good dog, it then gets a top-notch handler to do all the things with it. And so it's harder to compete if you don't get your dog out and get it seen.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be seen to be competitive. And I think we do have some problems there at times. But I would still tackle it. Well, I couldn't do it anymore, but I would still tackle it any time as the way I did it because, quite frankly, I didn't get any enjoyment out of all those championships that I didn't get to see.
Right.
I wanted to be part of it. I didn't want the phone call to say, oh, by the way, your dog finished. Oh, whoopee.
<You know? laughs>
I'm sorry. I wanted to do it myself.
Right. So your top three best tips to people that are just getting started, that they're learning to breed dogs or they're learning to show dogs. As a breeder, owner, handler yourself, and lots of time in, what's your three best recommendations for these folks?
As a breeder, go and study your breed, not only the dogs in the ring, but all the information you can get on the breed before you buy or acquire that dog that is going to be the foundation stock, because you can't afford mistakes anymore. Our kennels are too small. You can't start off with the pet that you decide should be bred, and then you're living with all the things behind it that you didn't know existed. So that would be number one for me. As an exhibitor, an owner-handler, observe what the handlers are doing. Other handlers, you know, the number of times I use the same pattern in my ring almost all the time. The number of times that I will have people come in after 150 dogs and head the wrong direction. I keep thinking maybe I'm not speaking English anymore. They really don't observe. You know, we always tell people to do this. We tell the kids to do this, the junior handlers. But people don't observe and see what is happening. Why is that dog being moved faster one way than another? Why is that dog who's like a bat out of hell from the side?
Well, there's probably a reason.
Yeah, that's it. But the people, if they would analyze what the reason is and then try to apply it to their own dog.
Mm-hmm.
And the odd time I did this last weekend. I said to this lady, you're just moving too fast to accommodate the shoulder. And she won the breed under me, but the next day she won the breed again. I was really pleased to see that. And she said, thank you, because she's able to see for herself what she was or was not doing with the dog. So that is what I would do if I'm going to be an owner-handler. I would suggest you really pay attention. As I said, this young family in which the father is there taping, you know, this iPad, the class, and what they're doing in it so it can show them afterward, I thought was marvelous.
Yep, great learning tool.
And you can take a look and say, look what you did there. That's what you did there. Look what you didn't do. Look what so-and-so did.
Right.
I mean, not in a pejorative way.
Right,
just in a helpful way.
Right.
And
absolutely,
that was something we never had, you know. And Judge one day walked up to me and said to me, young man, because I was a young man in those days, why are you wearing that black? And I said, well, I'm basically wearing black suits. He said, you shouldn't do it when you're kneeling behind a black Scotty. And I thought, oh.
Yes, it does lose the picture.
It does. And the same with women and some of the shoes they wear with their heels. I mean, it just so distracts.
Right.
From as they're moving, you want to see this effortless movement. Instead, you're getting effortless dog and clunk, clunk, clunk with the handler. Not good.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
And you don't always notice it yourself. I mean, you don't think about it.
Right. And I think that that's absolutely critical that we are aware. And I love video, particularly now that we have all this technology. You can do anything you want and you can see
exactly
what the judge sees. And I think that's a fabulous learning tool.
Yes, and I agree. And it is interesting, and a few do show up. I had a few weeks ago, I did best in show at a show, went back to the hotel half an hour later, and opened up my emails, and there from somebody who was 2,000 miles away with a gym, I would have done exactly the same. I watched those dogs going around, I'd have put this one and this one.
Oh,
you
my
know?
Gosh.
And thinking,
right.
Ah.
No, you're definitely on video. Great.
Although, I know, things you don't necessarily want on video.
Right.
They're there because sometimes, I must admit, I'm not a good poker face. Sometimes, in the old days, a couple of handlers would go by and they'd kind of take their fingers to the corners of their mouth and lift it up and think, uh-oh. So I'd smile a little more.
Right.
Because it's all there. But as a handler, too, when you're presenting your dog, the whole picture is being made. And I don't turn around to catch somebody off guard. You don't do it that way. But you do when you turn, if somebody is not paying attention and they let their dog be shown, let's say, standing cowhock someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Then that takes you back and say, well, how did that dog move? Oh, we'll move it again. So your eye's been drawn, even though maybe it wasn't the first time when everything was being held together, if you want, or being shown properly.
Right.
So I think it's really important, and I agree with you. It's a tremendous tool.
Absolutely. Okay, so I ask this of each of our guests in closing. Any suggestions that you can offer up to sort of the long-term members of the Fancy, folks like us that have been doing it pretty much our whole lives, to help mentor the new folks that are coming in? What can we do to encourage or to help or to grow the sport?
I think what you can do and is when people come along, and we've developed some marvelous young people compared to when I started. Trust me, I have more respect for handlers that we have now than I ever did 30 or 40 years ago. We have some great young people. But give them opportunities too. They shouldn't always be the ones that are carrying the mop and all the rest of it. They should have their opportunity with that exceptional dog, and they should be, you know, they can win with. I understand that the client may not always like it, but some clients would. Mm-hmm. On occasion, because you've got to achieve, be able to be successful to want to keep doing something. If you're keeping it over the head, you drop out, you leave.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time tremendously. I know you're headed off to a dog show this weekend, so enjoy.
I will do. Thank you very much, Laura. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Great. Have a great day. As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.